Welcome to Many Minds, a podcast about our world's spectacular varieties of mind and what we can learn from them. We feature conversations that shed light on the diverse ways of thinking, sensing, and being that are out there. I'm your host, Kenzie Cooper-Ryder. Thanks for joining us. All right, friends, we've come to the end of the 2025 run of Many Minds. Our final episode of the year is an audio essay by yours truly. This is a classic format for the show, one that we only do every so often. Today's essay is about names. It's about the question of whether animals have something like names for each other. And it's also about a deeper question. What even is a name? How do humans use names? How does the historical and ethnographic record kind of complicate our everyday understanding of what names are? I had a lot of fun putting this together, and I do hope you enjoy it. Now, the holiday season is a time when people might be shopping around for new podcasts to listen to. That makes it a great time to recommend us to your friends and family and colleagues. You can think of it as an especially thoughtful gift, one that's absolutely free, and that keeps on giving throughout the year. Speaking of gifts, as an addendum to this episode, you'll find a little stocking stuffer after the credits. It's a reading of a poem that figures prominently in today's essay. All right, friends, without further ado, here is my essay, In Search of Names. Enjoy. Cats have three names, or so writes T.S. Eliot in his 1939 poem, The Naming of Cats. First, Eliot tells us, there's a cat's sensible everyday name. The one that you use to call them, Victor, Plato, and Electra, would all fit the bill. Then there's a second name, more peculiar in particular, something like Quaxo, or Jellylorum, or Bombalurina. Dignified names that allow the cat to, quote, keep up his tail perpendicular, spread out his whiskers, and cherish his pride. But there's still another name, a third one. Eliot gives no examples. It's a name that only the cat knows and will never confess. Eliot's poem is playful, at most half-serious. It's part of a whimsical collection called Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. But underneath the whimsy, there's something of real interest to Eliot. Elsewhere in the collection, he observes that cats have individual taste preferences. Some favor rabbit, others caviar or salmon paste. And he writes that, quote, cats are much like you and me, and other people whom you'll find, possessed of various kinds of mind, end quote. And Eliot senses, or notices, we might say, that nothing distills individuality, nothing crystallizes identity, quite like a name. Eliot might be tickled to learn that cats do know their names. A 2019 study found that domestic cats were able to distinguish the sound of their own names from words for objects and from the names of the other cats they live with. A later study found that they also know the names of their feline friends. So cats are tuned in to the names that humans give them. But what about that third name? Do cats, or for that matter, any animals, give themselves names? Do they entertain symbols of some kind that pick out individuals, that set apart self from other, and differentiate one friend from another? Names would seem to be among the most basic tools of social life. Are we really the only species that uses them? Well, no, at least according to a wave of recent research. Early glimmers of animal names came from the oceans. A series of studies in the 1960s reported that common bottlenose dolphins each produce a distinctive whistle contour, a sound unique to the individual. These became known as signature whistles, and they've now been subject to decades of research. We figured out that these whistles are learned. They're not just dictated by the animal's vocal anatomy, as a voice would be. A young dolphin settles on their signature whistle in the first few months of life, and after that, the whistle proves stable. We now know that dolphins often produce these whistles when they get separated from the group, a bit like calling out into the fog, "It's Kenzie, over here!" But it gets more interesting. A dolphin will also, at least on occasion, produce another dolphin's signature whistle, as if addressing them. It might be tempting to think that this is just in-the-moment mimicry, but apparently not. Dolphins reliably recognize the signature whistles of their friends, and they remember them for decades. The search for animal names has now broadened out. In 2024, researchers reported a similar phenomenon in African elephants. Elephants often communicate through rumbles, low-frequency sounds that they make when they greet each other, for example, or when an elephant gets separated from the group. The researchers analyzed 469 of these rumbles in painstaking detail. They found that the elephants directed different rumbles to different individuals, as if, again, addressing them. Further, the scientists set up a playback experiment to show that the animals responded selectively to the rumbles that had originally been addressed to them. What's more, there's no evidence that these name-like rumbles were based on imitating one another's sounds. This contrasts with the dolphins. Recall that when bottlenose dolphins address each other, they do this by imitating each other's signature sounds. Elephants are not doing that. According to the authors, their name-like rumbles are arbitrary and thus suggest, quote, some capacity for symbolic thought, end quote. Another study from 2024 reported the use of name-like labels in marmosets. Marmosets are a small South American monkey with distinctive ear tufts. They live in family groups, usually in dense forests. As marmosets go about their lives, they banter back and forth with short fee calls. These are also a kind of contact call, much like the signature whistles in dolphins and like some of those rumbles in elephants. The researchers set up a simple experiment to explore whether marmoset fee calls might have name-like qualities. In the setup, two marmosets who know each other would enter an enclosure. Shortly after, a barrier would emerge, putting the animals out of visual contact. This was, of course, an attempt to induce fee calls, and it worked. After carrying out this procedure with 10 different marmosets in many different pairings, the researchers had amassed a dataset of more than 53,000 fee calls. Their analysis revealed that, as suspected, marmosets directed different fee calls to different individuals. The researchers also found that these animals responded selectively to the fee calls directed at them, and that different marmosets used similar fee calls to address the same receiver. Finally, as with the elephants, these name-like calls were not mere imitations of their friends. They seemed to be, again, arbitrary. So here we have, on three different branches of the tree of life, something intriguingly like names. We have vocal labels that seem to pick out specific individuals. These are labels that are learned early in life, labels that the animals respond to in playback experiments, and labels that, at least for the elephants and marmosets, are not formed through imitation. The labels seem to be rather like arbitrary symbols, in the same way that Kenzie is an arbitrary symbol for yours truly, and Bombalurina is an arbitrary symbol for some dignified cat. So maybe we're not the only ones to use names. Maybe this basic tool of social life has actually been discovered independently three other times, or maybe many more. Not everyone is convinced. A critic of the marmoset study writes that these results can be readily explained without invoking, quote, symbolic representations of individuals, end quote. Rather, the animals could simply be blending their own call with the call of the animal they're addressing. This would be a bit like how people automatically adopt some of the vocal features of people they're talking to. The same could be going on, in theory, with the elephants. Even if we accept the original researchers' lofty interpretations, there are clear ways in which these calls, rumbles, and whistles differ from how human names seem to be used. Take the dolphins. According to estimates, a dolphin's signature whistle accounts for 38 to 70% of their total vocal output. That's a lot. Imagine a person wandering around the world, mostly just repeating their own name. Or consider the elephants. The name-like component of the elephant's rumbles was actually just a tiny portion of the acoustic signal. The rest of it was dominated by features that were indicative of the caller, not the addressee. In the marmosets, it wasn't all animals that shared a label for a given individual. Only animals within a family group seemed to converge on a particular form of address. Now, perhaps it would be unfair to come down too hard on this research. This kind of work is extremely challenging, like all work on animal communication. Take again an elephant's rumble. To understand it, we need to figure out which of the many features of the sound could be meaningful. We need to puzzle out what elephants might want to mean. As we do all this, we need to consider context in all its many dimensions, and of course, we need to consider the radically different sensoria of these majestic creatures. This is all, to say the least, tricky. But that's not all. There's also a challenge presented by names specifically. When we ask whether animals have names, we're implicitly asking whether they have human-like names. we're imagining a certain picture, a certain prototype of how human names are formed and how they function. If we have a misleading picture, our search for animal names might go astray. We might go looking in the wrong places. We could end up holding animal names to unreasonable standards and discard phenomena that are in fact quite human-like. So before we continue our search for animal names, before we dig deeper into these whistles and rumbles and calls, before we move on to examine the trills and tweets and chitters of other creatures, we would do well to pause and consider a basic question. What really is a name? Or, as Shakespeare put it, what's in a name? There's a common sense answer, and it can be boiled down to a couple of propositions. A first is that names are, in an important sense, arbitrary. Hilda, Heidi, Henry, these are just collections of sounds, selected by a culture, more or less at random, as a serviceable way of distinguishing one person from another. A second part of the common sense view is that names function to pick out individuals. This is their reason for being, and they're very different from words in this respect. The word panda picks out a whole category of animals, after all. The name Penelope picks out just one individual. This all seems sensible, unobjectionable, but it turns out this common sense view of names is a bit of a distortion, one that results from thinking that the way we do things around here, around now, is somehow natural and inevitable. When we look across the breadth and diversity of human names and human naming practices, we realize that this common sense view is, if not altogether wrong, at best incomplete. Names, it turns out, are a subtle sort, straightforward on their surfaces, but stratified and shifting in their depths. Let's start with the idea that names are arbitrary. This is certainly true in the narrow sense that the sounds of names in spoken languages are not meant to sound like the people they refer to. But arbitrary has other connotations, like plucked out of the ether, or equally well applied to anyone. And names are not, in this sense, arbitrary. This was abundantly clear in a 1988 study by the sociologist Richard Alfred, still one of the only studies to take a systematic look at names across cultures. He examined the naming practices of 60 small-scale non-industrial cultures from around the world. In more than two-thirds of these societies, names were not mere strings of sound. They were semantically meaningful. They were formed out of descriptive words or phrases. These are names like little eyes, or eagle, or white-haired, names that capture something about what the child looks like or acts like. Other names might allude to something that happened around the birth. A child in New Guinea, for instance, might be named for a kind of nut that her mother was picking when her labor started. A fifth of the societies in Alfred's study, in fact, used a particular type of meaningful name, derogatory names like hyena droppings, idiot pig, or rubbish heap. These were names meant to ward off spirits with ill intentions. Meaningful names are also the norm in many signed languages. In Katakalik, for example, a village sign language in Bali, name signs usually reference a personal feature or characteristic. One traces a mustache, another depicts someone talking, an allusion to their gossipy nature. A third name sign imitates the way that a young girl would frequently misproduce the sign for ghost. A study of Greek sign language found that 92% of signers had descriptive names like these. In the spoken languages of the Anglo-European world, descriptive names are unusual. We think of names as a special pocket of language. Linguists often refer to a language's storehouse of words as its lexicon. Name researchers sometimes refer to a culture's storehouse of names as its onomasticon. In the Anglo-European world, these storehouses have only scattered overlap. There are exceptions, like Rose or Faith or Grace, but most names are just names. But Alfred's study suggests that in many cultures, perhaps most over the long sweep of human history, the lexicon and the onomasticon are not so easy to tell apart. There's a subtler sense in which many names are not purely arbitrary. Certain names just feel right, others just feel wrong. New parents often wait to meet a child so they can decide which name fits. New pet owners do a similar thing. Exactly what people are keen on when they do this is not always clear, but we know that words are non-arbitrary in all kinds of ways, that certain sounds evoke qualities like roundness, roughness, or smallness. It would be surprising if names didn't work by similar principles. One study found, in fact, that people expect those with the name Bob to have a relatively round profile and those with the name Kirk to have a relatively angular one. Another found that people expect certain names to go with certain personalities. Associations like these could very well come into play when parents or pet owners are first bestowing a name. There's also evidence that whether or not people are aptly named at birth, they grow into their names. This is an old idea. It's sometimes captured in the Latin phrase nomen est omen, or the term nominative determinism. Modern research actually supports it to a degree. One line of work has found that people's names are judged to fit their faces, something known as the face name matching effect. Interestingly, this effect has been found only in adults, not children. A plausible interpretation is that over our lives, we mold aspects of our appearance, like our hairstyles, to better fit our names. Another study analyzed the names of more than 300,000 doctors and found that, more often than you would expect by chance, their last names had something to do with medicine or even their subspecialty. The senior author was an orthopedic surgeon, Dr. D. Lim. So it seems that the idea that names are arbitrary is just too swift. Human names are often meaningful, whether because they repurpose meaningful words to describe their bearers, or because they match their bearers in more subtle, hard-to-articulate ways. What about that second pillar of the common sense view of names? The idea that names function to single out individuals. Implicit in this is the idea that names stand in stark opposition to words, which pick out broad categories. But already we've seen evidence that words and names are not always crisply distinct. In many cultures, names are formed out of words. Still, the generalization holds that the word panda picks out a huge number of possible references, while the name Penelope picks out just one. Or does it? There are estimated to be around 2,000 pandas left today. Meanwhile, there were 5,741 Penelopes born in the U.S. in 2024. This is a bit unfair, perhaps. Many of those Penelopes are likely more or less unique when we zoom in to their small social spheres. In other words, when we stick to an appropriate scale, names do pick out individuals. Except when they don't. The heavyweight boxer George Foreman famously had five sons, all named George. In villages in Scotland, this kind of problem was once pervasive. In the early part of the 20th century, a school in the coastal village of Embo had 13 boys named William McKay, all in attendance at once. Now, importantly, when names are this hopelessly multi-referential, people resort to other ways of picking out individuals, nicknames or shortenings. Some Penelopes are no doubt pennies. In everyday life, George Foreman's sons were known as Junior, Monk, Big Wheel, Red, and Little Joey. The William McKay boys were known as Willie A, Willie B, Willie C, and so on. Faced with this kind of massive multi-referentiality, at one time, people in the Caribbean would refer to others by their license plate numbers. This raises a question. What are names doing if they're not uniquely picking out individuals? What other functions are they serving? The answer is that, contra the common sense view, a name does much more than single out. It also tells us about the person giving a name. It tells us about time and place, about culture and class. Above all, it tells us about relationships. The relationship between the person using the name and the person named, but also about the relationships between the person named and the rest of their social universe. Anthropologists and sociologists have long known this. In his study, Alfred described a split between cultures that use names to differentiate people and cultures that use names, in effect, to categorize them. Categorizing names can be loaded with information about clan and kin, about lineage and locality. In Yagwe, for instance, a language from the highlands of Papua New Guinea, a boy's name contains a bit that references his father's lineage, a bit that references his mother's lineage, and a final bit that signals both his gender and his birth order. Elsewhere in New Guinea, names make explicit reference to clan lands, or come from a vault of names known to belong to a particular clan. When we survey the literature on names across cultures, we find, in fact, that names reflect relationships in a startling variety of ways. Technonymy, for instance, is found the world over. This is a practice by which a parent comes to be referred to by the names of their children. In the Anglosphere, this is occasional and informal. Elsewhere, it's codified. In the Penan of Borneo, people assume a new name when a loved one dies, and then often another and another. Claude Lévi-Strauss remarked that a Penan person may move through six or seven of these necronyms before marriage. In parts of New Guinea, friends adopt reciprocal names based on shared food experiences. If you and I have a memorable meal of pig's liver, we may call each other that pig's liver for the rest of our lives. Around the world, then, for a variety of reasons, the same person may be known by several names at once and by different names at different times. We tend to think of the name as a stable symbol, a fixed signifier given to us at birth that remains fused with our identity until death. But names, in fact, shift, because people and relationships do. The relationality of names is also seen in name taboos. These are widespread across the globe. Names seem to be among the most tabooed bits of language. These prohibitions come in different flavors. It's commonly frowned upon to address one's in-laws by name. In some places, you would never utter the name of your spouse. Taboos like this can be so strong that not only should you avoid the name itself, you should also avoid words that sound like the name. Name taboos may seem exotic, but they're hardly alien to the Anglo-European world. Consider, for instance, how uncommon it is, how utterly strange, in fact, to address one's parents by their names. Or consider the fact that many people report anxiety around saying others' names, even if they know them. Psychologists have recently described this feeling of discomfort as a widespread phenomenon, and they've given it a name, alexinomia. Because names bundle so much together, because they compress so much information about the social worlds in which they're embedded, researchers have long used names as windows into culture and as telling little indicators of cultural change. An interesting case is an upswell of research around name uniqueness. If you have a culture of 100 people and each has a different name, name uniqueness is high, maxed out, in fact. If everyone is named George or William, it is low. Naturally, most cultures sit between these extremes. We also know from past work that cultures that score high on name uniqueness also tend to score high on individualism. That is, they tend to value individual autonomy and self-expression. It's recently been observed that name uniqueness is on the rise in Japan and China, places traditionally associated with collectivistic, not individualistic values. This may in fact be a global trend. A 2025 study charts name uniqueness over 500 years of Western history, finding a general upward drift in Russia, Sweden, Argentina, and every other country surveyed. Names also allow us to trace other cultural shifts. In 1985, the columnist William Sapphire asked readers to send in the names of their pet dogs so he could sniff out any trends. Surveying the 12,000 names he received in response, he concluded that, quote, canine nomenclature is taking a turn for the human, end quote. We used to name dogs based on disposition and appearance, he wrote, but increasingly we're giving them names for people. Other data bears this out. A few years later, the anthropologist Stanley Brandes went to Hartsdale Cemetery outside of New York City, possibly the oldest pet cemetery in the world. He pored over the grave markers and came to the same conclusion as Sapphire. Through the 1980s, he noted, it was common to find dog names like Champ, Rusty, and Spaghetti. But the later gravestones were more likely to feature names like Ronnie, Rebecca, and Oliver. Brandes noted that on some of the earliest grave markers from the early 1900s, no names are in evidence. There were simply dedications to my pet. If names are a window into culture and relationships, so is their absence. Consider, for instance, the perennial debate about whether scientists should name their lab animals. It's a debate that implicitly acknowledges that names are much more than utilitarian tags. We name what we value and what we value talking about. We have a nominative impulse that extends far beyond other humans, far beyond our pets, in fact. We name storms and yachts, streets and trees. Surfers name famous wave patterns. Astronomers name stars and asteroids and bits of space junk. A recent article in the New York Times describes a growing trend toward naming houses. Our zeal for place naming is particularly impressive, and it may even rival our zeal for person naming. The writer John McPhee once profiled an island in the Scottish Hebrides that had only 138 inhabitants and 1,600 place names. What does all this suggest about our prospects for discovering animal names? I'm not saying that we should expect animal names to have all the cultural layers and trappings that human names do. But if we are to succeed in our search, we would do well to move past a common sense view of what names are and how they work. We would do well to loosen our imaginations a bit. With a more expansive understanding, we might in fact reorient our search, or broaden it. For starters, names that repurpose existing communicative signals would not be unexpected. In fact, they might be among the first places to look. Nor would it be surprising, actually, if the same names are used over and over within an animal community. Similarly, it shouldn't be surprising if a single animal has several names, or if an animal's name changes over the lifespan. We also need not restrict our search to names for other animals. Who's to say an elephant wouldn't name a watering hole? Will this make our search for animal names easier? Quite the opposite, I'm afraid. And we still need to allow for the possibility that animal names could be radically different from human names, that the human historical and ethnographic record is throwing us off the scent. We need to allow for the possibility that, to tweak a Wittgenstein quote, if a lion could speak its name, we wouldn't understand it. T.S. Eliot himself was not optimistic about the prospect of uncovering animal names, or at least the ones they give themselves. A cat's third name, according to Eliot, is something that, quote, no human research can discover, end quote. He claims it is ultimately an object of private meditation. Eliot's poem closes with the image of a cat in rapt contemplation of his third name. His, quote, ineffable, effable, effin ineffable, deep and inscrutable singular name. The Many Minds podcast is a project of the Diverse Intelligences Summer Institute, which is made possible by a generous grant from the John Templeton Foundation to Indiana University. I'm Kenzie Cooper-Reiter. Thanks so much for listening. The Naming of Cats by T.S. Eliot. The naming of cats is a difficult matter. It isn't just one of your holiday games. You may think at first I'm as mad as a hatter when I tell you a cat must have three different names. First of all, there's a name that the family used daily, such as Peter, Augustus, Alonzo, or James, such as Victor or Jonathan, George or Bill Bailey. All of them sensible, everyday names. There are fancier names if you think they sound sweeter, some for the gentlemen, some for the dames, such as Plato, Admetus, Electra, Demeter. But all of them sensible, everyday names. But I tell you, a cat needs a name that's particular, a name that's peculiar and more dignified, else how can he keep up his tail perpendicular, or spread out his whiskers, or cherish his pride? Of names of this kind I can give you a quorum, such as Munkustrap, Quaxo, or Coracopat, such as Bombalurina, or else Jellylorum, names that never belong to more than one cat. But above and beyond, there's still one name left over, and that is the name that you will never guess. The name that no human research can discover, but the cat himself knows and will never confess. When you notice a cat in profound meditation, the reason, I tell you, is always the same. His mind is engaged in a rapt contemplation of the thought, of the thought, of the thought of his name, his ineffable, effable, effin ineffable, deep and inscrutable, singular name.